To talk about what he himself refers to as my weirdo career, it is my great pleasure to welcome the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick. So we have a few things in common, and one of them is literature, comparative literature.
We used to call it fancy English.
True, it's a strange thing. I mean, people always ask me, what do we compare, really? So I said we had three things in common. Another one is that we have Russian ancestry. Your parents, grandparents, my grandparents are from Chernovitz. And then it's quite a pleasure to have someone on stage with me today. It's probably one of the first times that actually is more or less my age, so I'm quite pleased by that.
But I'm beautifully preserved.
No, true, very, very. And it's cool enough in this room for us to...
Should tell you that when in about 1987 or so, the Washington Post decided to send me to Russia because no one else would go. It's very cold, and the language is hard, and the food is very fatty. And despite all this revolutionary fervor, no one else wanted to go, and I was very low on the totem pole, to say the least. And it was my duty to fly with my then-girlfriend, soon-to-be wife, Esther Fine, who was working for The Times, to a very unusual place for Jews in those days, Miami Beach, Florida, on Collins Avenue, to announce to my grandfather, who had left Russia on an ox cart or something. Do they have ox? You know, chased by Cossacks and, you know, just reaching the border and finally making it to Paterson, New Jersey by way of Rivington Street. That I was going to marry this woman, which pleased him. She was suitably Hebraic. And so there was no head-in-oven operation. But that I was going to move with her, and we were going to set up house, as they used to say, in Moscow. And he looked at me and he said, and in some mixture of Yiddish and English, he said, "You have lost," and he was 103, "you have lost your mind." He just could not conceive of this, that voluntarily, unchased by the American version of Cossacks, that I would move to Moscow and live there with the greatest of pleasure, which we did for 4 years.
I think that's a perfect segue for what I'd like to ask you about now. Remember when I had you on the phone not long ago, I wanted you to say something about yourself. And
it wasn't a long conversation.
No, it wasn't a long conversation, but we'll get to that in a little bit. And I asked you, how would you like me to describe you? And you said, Paul. Then there was a pause, which definitely was a comma. Paul, I'm the editor of The New Yorker. Is there anything else you would like to know?
Which sounds horrible, but
is a man who doesn't have time to lose. I mean, he's writing something, he's in the middle of 54 plans. No, I didn't think it sounded horrible at all.
I was watching a Sopranos episode on my computer.
But subsequently, I read that you have beautiful things to say about editors. You say that they are a mouse training to become a rat. So, well, let's speak about Catherine Graham. That's another extraordinary profile and filled with extraordinary stories about your time in Russia. And so I'd like to talk a little bit with you about how the sausage gets made. You have...
I was the sausage in that case.
You were?
Yes.
I'm particularly... I think neither of us believes in flattery, but I do think that your first sentences are very strong. I like them enormously. I like the first sentence of the Netanyahu
essay. Well, I think it was
essay.
My friend Michael Spector who said, also grew up at the Washington Post, that after the lead, it's all typing. Now, that may not be an entirely literary point of view, but it is one of the many things that you're taught in the church.
Well, you learned that lesson very well, I feel, because the first sentence of your Netanyahu essay goes something like, if Paris is a city of light, Jerusalem is a city of opinion. The first sentence of the Catherine Graham essay, and then maybe you can elaborate a little bit on it, goes something like this. It actually goes like this exactly.
Whistle.
Yeah. In my boyhood as a reporter, I nearly killed the matriarch of the liberal media conspiracy.
It's very true. Catherine Graham, who, needless to say, had very little... I had met her once before. She would have what's called a new employee lunch every so often. And after I had been there for 4 years, I went to a new employee lunch. And I went to this new employee lunch, and I was covering sports, because that's what they would let me do at this point. I was covering the National Basketball Association, which was not that dear to her heart, nor was boxing. And she had her card, you know, kind of like Queen Elizabeth. And she came to me and she said, David Rennick, you cover the BNA. I do. 5 years later, I was in Moscow for 6 months, and it was announced to us in the bureau, which sounds like there are 20 people there. There are two of us, and I was the number two, and that Catherine Graham would be coming to interview Mikhail Gorbachev. And an interview with Mikhail Gorbachev in those days was a very, very big deal. Now he'll open a grocery store, but he was in the process of dissolving the last empire on Earth, except this one. And she was going to come, and we all thought, this is fantastic. We're going to interview Gorbachev. Wrong. She brought a flotilla of editors and, as they say in Russian, shishki, big pine cones, big shots. And and my job, I had one suit, which was more than you really needed in those days in Moscow. And the only time I wore the suit in 4 years was to dress up to drive Catherine Graham to a hairdresser. Catherine Graham was in Moscow, and we didn't go to the interview, but I drove her to the hairdresser, and the next morning after the interview, there were photographs of her and Gorbachev on the front pages of Pravda and Sovetskaya Rossiya and Izvestia. Her hair looked fantastic.
You made history, as you say.
Exactly. And then I was deputized to take her to the city that was known at the time as Leningrad. And what do you do with Catherine Graham in Leningrad? You take her to the Hermitage, and she looks at the paintings, and with that kind of eye that you and I don't have, which is that she may well purchase.
I sometimes have the eye, that's about all.
And then at night we went to the Kirov. No problem. The only problem is there was a second night. I had no idea. What do you do? Take her to a soccer game? No, yeah, you know, drinking? I thought, I'll take her to the circus. Very intimate circus, lots of fun. Kids love it. Old people, they love this stuff. There is no head of state to interview in Leningrad, and we go to the circus, and after 45 minutes, she is bored to tears. You know, the clowns, they're great. And suddenly she said in this kind of tone of voice and with the use of the subjunctive, some tense that normal people don't have, I think I would rather go, or something like that. And okay, we'll go. And nets were being lowered over the arena, and which meant it was time for the wild cats and lions and so on. And I didn't think anything of it, and I went down the stairs, and there was one of those babushki, you know, sort of stout women that you see, you know, guarding paintings and train stations and public urinals and so on. And she said in Russian, "Нельзя," it's impossible, you can't go. And I said back in Russian, I hope using the proper accusative case, you don't understand. this woman has a fatal disease. We must leave. And she melted butter-like, and we went down the stairs, and we passed this kind of box, kind of with slats, about the size of a small coffin. And I passed by it, and Catherine Graham started to pass by it. And as she was passing by it, a claw went, and missed Catherine Graham's rather shapely a calf by about a quarter of an inch, and she sprinted to the waiting limousine. She got in the back seat of this limousine and she said, "That was fantastic."
But you tell the story deliciously, and then right when you finish this, you say to the reader,
"I know nothing about this."
This gentle reader nothing. That I am, reading you to prepare, you know, while I'm preparing for the evening tonight, you're probably, writing two or three articles. You say, the story, of course, revealed nothing of Mrs. Graham.
This is true. This is what you discover, of course, if you have half a brain and any humility about journalism or life, that you don't know anybody. You barely know your wife or your husband or your brother or your sister or your parents. And so this whole process of diving in, and needless to say, it's not the first time I've told that story, and dined out on it for years, and I knew nothing about this woman. And then years later, this autobiography came out, and I read this book, and it was fantastic.
Because?
Well, she was utterly exposed. Her story was unbelievable. She was raised by these rather mad mother and fascinating father, and combination of neglect and ignorance. I think she found out that she was half Jewish in her freshman year at Smith. I mean, it's a very strange story, and she tells it nakedly and brilliantly, and worked really hard on it. It didn't feel like one of those autobiographies that's a sort of after dinner speech sort of thing.
And particularly the marital.
And her husband, who she married, one of these kind of great young things of Washington, Philip Graham, who was going to be the next Felix Frankfurter and maybe run the Washington Post. And in fact, he was mentally ill and committed suicide and humiliated her terribly in the process, although she loved him dearly. And she suddenly inherits the Washington Post, which she was not equipped for at all, seemingly. And she has one of these rare lives that, when called on to do the right thing, three or four times in her life, she did it. She hired Ben Bradley. She published the Pentagon Papers along with the New York Times. By the way, and the Washington Post wasn't even the best newspaper in Washington for a long time. And, of course, supported the Watergate reporters, Woodward and Bernstein and the rest of them, when they were utterly alone. Utterly alone. I just thought it was an arresting story on its own, but also yet another instance of not knowing a thing about it.
We'll come back to what I might call your is it a fascination or a commitment to vulnerability? I think you're particularly interested in people who reveal a fissure or show a weakness or
when we were talking on the phone, I said that there. You rightly pointed out that that a lot of these pieces are about losing.
And failure.
Life is mostly about losing. Life is a thrilling but corrosive process at many times, and certainly, journalistically, especially when you're trying to write about people who are known, who are often surrounded by the armature and the armor of public relations and cliche and deflection and defense, that your only shot at anything revealing is in moments of departure, loss, moments of quiet and apartness. The least typical thing in life is winning, big wins. You know, that's what the press focuses on very often, whether it's in politics or anything else. But not only is that an atypical experience, it's also it's an opportunity for optimal cliche and bad reporting.
Which is why in your book we do discover people like Al Gore. I mean, not to necessarily belabor this, but and we're failure,
Tony Blair.
Falling.
Tony Blair, in the midst of running last time, basically, you know, having discovered, like some of us, that the business of invading Iraq was actually a disaster, and that he had to face the British public in an election tied to George Bush, which is not the most natural fit for him. And the only way for him to win was to endure a kind of masochism campaign in which he allowed himself to be beaten up as often as possible and as frequently as possible on television or any other means. And he was quite revealing in that mode.
Particularly this culture in this country is very much about winning. And I've often thought that I should do a whole series on the notion of failure. Would you come?
Yeah, I'll be there.
Okay. Because failure transcontinental, I mean, what appears as failure here, I think, is very different from what appears as failure maybe in some parts of Europe. Let's get to the last sentence.
That's why English sports writing is so wonderful, because they're always losing. And, you know, and that's a much better subject.
Is there some pleasure in seeing someone failing, a form of Schadenfreude?
Well, as the saying goes, England is the only country where they have Schadenfreude for themselves. Look, there is a predatory aspect of journalism that, as Janet Malcolm reminds us in the starkest and maybe full-blownest of terms, if that's a word, there is a predatory aspect to journalism, even practiced with integrity and even a measure of delicacy. There is a measure of when you go to see Al Gore when he's still in the throes of suffering, or Mike Tyson, or Tony Blair, any number of these people in this book or written by other people, that you know what you're doing. You know perfectly well what you're doing. But with famous people, they also know what you're up to, and so the transaction is quite complicated.
Tension.
Pardon me?
Tension.
Tension and a kind of he knows that you know that she knows that, you know, this kind of odd back and forth.
Now, the last sentence from the Katharine Graham piece, fodder for thought, I think. During Watergate, Katharine Graham was prepared not only to publish and support her reporters, but also to protect them by every means available to her. Her values as well as her courage seem increasingly endangered. Why?
Well, we don't have all night. That they are endangered is, I think, obvious. And we're talking about all the media, television and newspapers and the rest. I think it was encouraging, at least to me, that this last round of Pulitzer Prizes included investigative pieces that showed real balls. There's no other word for it. The fact that the New York Times, despite Bush calling in the executives, published their pieces on NSA warrantless wiretapping, or the Washington Post published pieces about secret prisons, or, by the way, the New Yorker publishing Jane Mayer on all kinds of torture, or Abu Ghraib and the rest, I think that it's absolutely necessary and maybe not as common as it ought to be. And I, for all the reasons that we know all too well that have become a kind of litany, but true, whether it's profit motives or consolidation of media, that this is not exactly common, this kind of enterprise.
They want to know how you do it, David. How you manage to edit and report at the same time.
Because everybody has a cartoon of who they are. My cartoon is that. The cartoon is ruthlessly efficient and any number of things like that. I don't write that much. I write a couple of pieces a year. This is a collection. It's the first book in 7 or 8 years. I just finished reading New Grub Street again, George Gissing's great 19th century novel about the English literary scene. And I thought it was kind of a wonderful potboiler about crazy ambition and venality in the literary world and the journalistic world. And then I went back and I read the preface, which I usually don't in Penguin Classics because why bother?
You don't.
And it was announced to me that Gissing wrote this novel in 2.5 months at a rate of 4,000 words a day. That, to me, is quite something. Or Trollope marching off to be postmaster of wherever he was.
You have models that wrote even faster than you do.
Well, A.J. Liebling used to say that he could write better than anybody who wrote faster and faster than anybody who could write better. I don't even think that applies. It's not important. What's important is over time what gets written that's any good, which is rare.
Which may not include me at all as a part of the discussion.
But I'm
wondering if the speed, which is legendary and which might be a cartoon and might all of those things, but nevertheless, the same year that you're writing the translation wars, you're writing about Katrina.
There's another reason that I can write twice a year and get something else done is that there is an amazing staff at The New Yorker, a group of editors who themselves are remarkably intelligent.
But they don't write your pieces. They edit you.
They sure do. And thank God for it. It's basically my family, The New Yorker, and the occasional piece of writing. A lot of things go undone or unread or unthought about. That's the only way I know how to do it.
All right.
That and not sleeping very much. Which is uninteresting sleep, don't you think?
Well, but not sleeping is tiresome. I suffer from some mild forms of insomnia. I just feel like, why do I always need to make the night present? Some criticism has been leveled at the magazine, which you're well aware of, that it has become...
too political.
Maybe not too political. I think I was going to say too topical.
Right.
And that in some way, the speed at which articles are done, the fact that in some way some of the other journalists, reporters, and people who work at the magazine feel at times that what Roger Angel says, that the leisurely way in which the magazine used to be run has changed, partly because you, if I'm not mistaken, are the first or one of the first editors. There've only been five.
H.L. Mencken used to have a postcard, and every letter of complaint that came into him, or complaint or compliment or whatever it was, and the postcard used to say, "Dear Sir/Madam, you may be right." However.
I remember that. That's good.
I think that there are probably instances where I do everything wrong here or there. We are living in a highly, highly politicized moment. And my time as being editor is not the 90s, in which we were talking about, a vulgarized version of this concept, but the end of history, and we were going to have a stock market of 40,000, and everything was going to be kind of positive millennial thinking, and that hasn't been the case in 5 years. It's been, if by speeding up the process of knowing more about the places we have to know more about, the politics we have to know more about, has had that effect to some degree, then I would plead guilty. But for the most part, overall, I think it's a good thing. It may be a difficult thing for some writers sometimes, but I hope they're getting the time they need to do it right and well. I've stumped you.
No. You haven't really. Not yet.
Not yet.
No, I think we can talk a little bit about relationship between fact and fiction, and also how much value you put into objectivity.
Objectivity. I don't think that's a word that... I don't even know what that means anymore. I know what fairness means. I know journalistically. And I know what I mean by fact and fiction, and this is an interesting topic. Remember, I have to think about these in terms of the magazine. What writer X does on his or her own in a book under their name for a publisher is their business. And if they want to justify the mixing of made-up stuff, let's call a spade, with factual stuff, and call it, I don't know, factual magical realism, or call it Sam Greenberg, if you will, and if they want to justify it for reasons of postmodern notions of what's knowable and what's not knowable, blah, 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 that's fine, but not in my house. And I'll tell you the reason why I'm a conservative about this. I'm a conservative about it because when you read Cy Hirsch or Jane Mayer or George Packer or Philip Gurevich or any of the sort of political reporting, I want you to be assured that it is factual in the terms that I mean it, in the ways I think that we all mean it, which is that it is factual insofar as we could absolutely get to the bottom of the facts, whether through the reporting, the fact-checking, and all the rest. Once you start putting in conflations and made-up dialogue because it helps the thing along, et cetera, I'm sorry. You do that on your own time. Do that somewhere else, and I might read it. But to me, that's fiction. It's an interesting fiction. It's the use of fact in fiction. But to me, for the purposes of the New Yorker and the way the categories have to be kept straight, if that's conservative thinking about it, fine. There's a lot of writers that I enjoy, even in the New Yorker distant past, that I suspect had mixed things a bit. I don't think that's a tenable position in the New Yorker, at least while I'm around.
So how do you actually choose your subjects, and how do you prepare to write these profiles?
Well,
I'm thinking particularly Tony Blair would be a very good example of that. How do you go about that?
You asked about the editing. First of all, editing and writing are activities that John Cheever gave an interview, I think it was in the Paris Review, and he was asked to compare writing novels to writing short stories, and he said they're about as similar as swimming and shooting a gun. Odd metaphors.
Yeah.
But editing and writing, they're joined at one place somehow, like a figure eight. I mean, they do involve language, but writing is a kind of a solitary activity, and editing is actually not. Editing is this, but it's also, especially for somebody who's in charge of the whole shebang and has to deal with people, a very, at least the way I do it, I hope, a fairly gregarious activity, or at least in part it is. You want to stay away from anybody else's territory. And if I have a piece in mind, and again, we're talking about a couple of things a year, maximum, and suddenly a writer comes in and says, I want to do such and such, it is after you, Gaston. I mean, and then you come up with something else in the back of your mind, and maybe you do it and maybe you don't. So there's that process. I am never going to write, you know, in terms of foreign politics, about South America, China, all the many places in the world that are not this little patch of business in the Middle East, and Russia, because I don't know anything about them. I'd love to read about them. It's hard enough for me to keep up with those two places as it is. So, you know, I'm 47 now, and I'm suddenly going to become a China expert, or, you know, I'd love to go, and going for the New Yorker is a great way to go because they pay your ticket, and no matter what foolishness you write, the editor will let it in, but so that narrows it. Geographically, it's narrowed, and what Mitchell did, I forget about the quality of it, the business of writing about Mr. Hunter's, that's just not what I'm equipped to do, or I can't see my way. Mark Singer can do that. Mark Singer can write a brilliant profile of four brothers who are doormen in New York, or which he did, the Brennan brothers. I just, my mind is, there's a real poverty there, I guess. Certainly, we're in, I just don't know how to do that.
And so how do you prepare for these interviews?
Read everything. And and the interview is not that important. Showing up is important. Showing up and showing up and showing up. The worst, most overrated form of any kind of journalism is head of state interviews. They yield nothing. And I don't mean just George
Except
Bush. Even Bill Clinton, as protean and intelligence as he is, he goes into that interview as head of state, and he is prepared. He knows what he is not going to say. And if he slips off of that preparation, it's an international incident. He's very aware of that. And so these things that journalists crave, get an interview with Bush, or as it turned out, the Gorbachev interview in Moscow, what was the lead to it? It was incredible what a false kipper was thrown to the Washington Post and Newsweek. The idea that there would be a joint Mars project between the United States and the Soviet Union that led the paper after all this geschrei about an interview with him. And so for somebody like Blair, there are 5 biographies to read. And you read them so you know what's already covered ground. You don't want to go into a Blair interview and say, are there any intellectual influences that you have? I mean, you've got limited time. You better know that his main intellectual influence was a Christian theologian, and he was at Oxford, and so on and so on. You have to know this and then get to the next level of detail. Otherwise, you've just wasted 10 minutes. That's the downside of interviewing anybody famous. Your time is limited.
Why is it that you don't write about yourself?
Very good question. I only do it very...
Is that the first good question I asked?
No.
It's the first time you say it, and I've been, you know, waiting, and I put all this effort in, anyway.
Paul, this is not a psychoanalytic session.
We're nearly done.
I ask myself that, and it's... When I read it in others, people who do it well, I admire it enormously, and if and when I try to do it, it feels like vanity. And this is a failing of a journalistic background, I suppose. I mean, life is not quite done with me yet in these regards, and we'll see. The last thing anybody wants is another memoir about editing. It feels like orthodonture. I mean, it's a failing. I've never done it because I've never done it well, so therefore never published
it. You tried?
Yeah, sure.
The United States has been wrong politically and morally about Iraq more than once in the past. Washington has supported Saddam against Iran and overlooked some of his bloodiest adventures. The price of being wrong yet again would be incalculable. History will not easily excuse us if, by deciding not to decide, we defer a reckoning with an aggressive totalitarian leader who intends not only to develop weapons of mass destruction, but also to use them. Saddam's abdication or a military coup would be a godsend. His sudden conversion to the wisdom of disarmament, almost as good. It is a fine thing to dream, but assuming such dreams are not realized, a return to a hollow pursuit of containment will be the most dangerous option of all. And this you signed, and it's in the issue of February 3rd, 2003 in The New Yorker. And
the glaring wrong thing is, and I was hardly alone, is that WMD was not only used there and thought to be present, it obviously was not. Now, there's been a lot of, very good journalism on why not. And this is, you know, a disastrous aspect of American foreign policy that has led us down this road that we know all too well about. Why did I feel the way I did about Iraq has nothing to do with 9/11. It certainly had nothing to do with some great affection for the Bush administration, which I and the magazine had criticized many times and pretty vociferously on covers and comments and pieces and all the rest, even before the war. But at that time, one had seen that Saddam Hussein had used, as we know, chemical weapons against Iran. It had invaded and occupied and intended to keep another country, Kuwait. You might not love Kuwait, but there it is. And it had used chemical weapons and killing thousands of its own people, Kurds, in the north. And as we now know also, Saddam Hussein crazily, as we know, there's a long piece in Foreign Affairs, this I guess, quarter, wanted his own people to believe that he still had this stuff for reasons of power, for reasons of holding power, of intimidation, of what a totalitarian leader does. But the fact of the matter is that at least at that time, in the months preceding the invasion, and certainly thereafter, all these things were absent. For whatever reason, history will tell us, but they were absent. And absent WMD, and absent a threat to neighbors or anyone else, the other rationales for war were not even remotely, to me, worthy of invasion. Now, criticism of the Bush administration has come from me, from other quarters, either more vociferously or less so in the magazine, over and over and over again, and not just about the conduct of the war, and not just about torture and all the more obvious things that have happened since. But I, you know, I'm not just a child of Vietnam. I'm also someone who has grown up and watched us delay and delay and delay a reckoning with Bosnia. And again, they're not necessarily absolutely analogous, but in terms of intervention and the use of intervention, I am not an isolationist. And I saw, as we all did, the absence of intervention in Bosnia and Kosovo or waiting far too long, leading to countless deaths. The complete absence of intervention in Rwanda leading to an incredible genocide. And that certainly shaped my thinking. Again, you can completely argue and probably be right that the analogy here with Iraq is not only imperfect, but far, far worse than that.
Do you have regrets for having...
How could you not? How could you not? What all I'm telling you is the circumstances of a right journalism or opinion is written in a moment in time.
But how do you think that you, David Remnick, were fooled?
Like we were... look, there were a lot of people who were against the war, so, and they were right. But I wasn't alone. I mean, there were people that I admire far more than the leaders, the heads of state, who were also, for these reasons, and... But that was quite reluctant rhetoric.
But it seems it's reluctant rhetoric. But it seems that what convinced you in part was a book you read about
no,
the
no,
situation.
No, not at all. No, you mean Kenneth Pollack? Yeah, no. But certainly by listening to what people like Adam Michnick or Václav Havel had to say about this, who to me are not bloody-minded conservative radicals, had a large influence on me.
Do you think Bush lied to the country?
Sure. Sure, if lying means the improper use of intelligence.
I think that's one definition.
If lying includes the selective use of intelligence and what Cy Hirsch has memorably called stovepiping of intelligence, so that it moves up through a process and unquestioned and unchallenged, then yes, I do. And we've written this countless times, including myself. But again, if you ask me, is that conclusion wrong? Absolutely. And there were people at the magazine who certainly argued that and who wrote it at the time, Rick Hertzberg. So,
but obviously your voice carries more weight.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think that my voice, I don't know how changed minds work in terms of editorials or comments or like that. I can't speak to that. I don't think we can be accused of underreporting or underwriting about
Israel,
Palestine, the Middle East, South Asia,
etc. Do you think that some countries in New Yorker should report on that?
Sure. Yesterday I was in Toronto, and a man in the back said, "Are you? Is the New Yorker interested in Canada and Canadian politics?"
I was just about to ask you.
It would be rude to say no. But it's really rude to say, to lie, and so I said, somewhat. What am I supposed to say? You remember Michael Kinsley had a contest of the most boring headline of all times, people would send in the worst headlines and the dullest headlines. And there was a headline over a Flora Lewis op-ed piece in the New York Times, and it was called "Some Worthwhile Canadian Initiatives." I have to say, that did not get a huge laugh last night. I kid the Canadian people, but I love them. I love them. I really do.
Somewhat.
Somewhat.
In your view, to conclude and then conclude our session, since you had asked me how long these things last, and I always say more or less as long as a psychoanalytical session, I feel we've gone over a bit, but I won't charge extra. Your ideal issue for a New Yorker.
So what is an ideal issue? Oh, I don't know. You know, it could be any number of things. I mean, if there were a novella that I thought were... For example, I just read Everyman, the Philip Roth novella. If that had been available to us, alas, it was not. Would have published it straight through. But not everything is available to you at any given moment. And, you know, the cliche of magazine editing and talking about magazines is, you know, it's a kind of meal or there's a mix. And it is true. And I was looking at a book about the New Yorker by Ben Ligota the other night, and in Sean's very whispery scrawl, he was the way kids will, you know, put Lou Gehrig at first base and, you know, somebody from another team at second, these kind of fantasy teams of great baseball nines. I know you're a huge fan.
I'm lost now.
I know.
Completely, but it was a ball.
They're with me.
It's a ball.
That he would also do these kind of ideal issues, and I have to plead guilty to doing this once in a while. And it, you know, sometimes a hilarious profile will go fantastically well with a deeply reported piece from some horrific place and this kind of shorts. But it doesn't always work out that way. We're always, you know, it's a weekly magazine, and the capacity to have one issue that is the kind of beau ideal is you're always, and the fault is probably mine more than anything else, you're always falling short of these Platonic ideals. And then you come back next week and you give it another shot.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.